welcome to Real Britannia. Today's date is Monday, the 3rd of October, 2022, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. We are racing through the year. We're now into October. It's almost Halloween, and then after that, Christmas. And of course, we are here today at the beginning of the week to discuss the week's news that is of interest to nationalists. And of course, I do have with me my co-host, Max Musson from Western Spring. Max, good day, sir. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well indeed. I'm just reading like everybody else is against the massive cock-up that the Conservatives seem to have made in terms of managing the economy, which used to be their forte and used to be the thing that they used to trumpet and in the face of the Labour Party, saying, you know, we're the people you can rely upon to run the economy better. We're not tax and spend. We don't cause financial crises. And yet here we are with it's almost as if Liz Truss is in competition with Jeremy Corbyn to as quickly as possible become the most disliked person in her party.
Yeah, I don't understand it really, to be honest, Max. I mean, it's this mini budget, and we almost talked about it last week, but it was all the Queen's funeral and other things that were going on, and we just ended up leaving it. But what it looks like to me is that they've cut taxes for the very rich. They've abolished the tax code if you're earning 45,000 and above. It's gone down to 40,000. But then they've also reduced the tax code for people at the lower end. They've reduced it from 20% to 19%. So obviously it's a smaller reduction if you're on a lower wage, and it's a higher reduction if you're on a higher wage, but it's still reducing taxes. And I would have thought people would be, you know, really happy about that. We're paying less tax. But no, apparently the banks the Bank of England had to step in. I mean, I really don't understand what these issues are. I'm hoping maybe you could illuminate exactly what is wrong with the budget, why the bank had to step in, and why everyone is so critical of Liz Truss now.
Well, I mean, I think that the primary thing is that from what I can make out from the reports in the newspapers, what was intended to be a mini budget has turned it out into being a full blown budget, effectively. Whereas Chancellors of the Exchequer would normally, before they present a full blown budget to Parliament, would normally run their ideas past the Office of Budgetary Responsibility, which is a kind of an international body that exists. I think it sort of comes under the auspices of the World Bank, etc. And they do all the number crunching to make sure that, you know, the plans that governments have when they put them forward to Parliament are properly costed, etc. And from what I can make out, it appears that the Conservatives didn't run this mini budget past the Office of Budgetary Responsibility. And that's why I think today, Kwasi Kwarteng and Liz Truss are in an emergency meeting with the Office of Budgetary Responsibility in order to try and allay their fears. And so because there were sweeping changes made in this budget, which appeared not to have been costed properly, or where the costing of them was questionable, and because those ideas hadn't been submitted so they could be double-checked, it caused the markets to panic, thinking, crikey, what's going on? The Conservative government is out of control in terms of what it's planning to do with regard to the economy. It's doing all these, making all these significant changes without them having been properly costed and without there being any comments coming forward from the Office of Budgetary Responsibility. But the financial crisis that we're facing at the moment, it has its roots, you know, back in the days of the pandemic. And this is, you know, one of the things that I keep coming back to when we do talk about, you know, the economy, because it's important that people understand that the mistake that Boris Johnson's government made in terms of the way in which it dealt with the pandemic was to effectively quarantine the healthy people by creating furlough, instead of only quarantining the people who actually had the disease. And so because we quarantined the healthy people, and there were very obviously very large numbers of those, because furlough lasted for 18 months from March 2020 through to September 2021, and cost something like about $300 billion in terms of additional government spending, that $300 billion of additional government spending was the government paying people to stay at home and not for them to go into factories where they're going to be making things and producing the goods and services to be sold. And so there was a marked shift. The government were injecting money into the economy by borrowing money and paying it to people for furlough, and that money was being spent. But there wasn't a commensurate increase in the goods and services that were available to be purchased. And so that in itself had to be inflationary. Inflation is caused where the amount of money in the economy expands at a greater rate than the available goods and services that are there to be purchased with that money. And because there's more money chasing a relatively smaller amount of goods and services around, it causes that the price of those goods and services to go up. And so firstly, we had that, where the government then had to borrow an extraordinary large amount of money, which took our national debt up to well over $2 trillion. And that then has created a situation where we've got a larger national debt than we've ever had before. And so that kind of thing tended to make the markets a bit jittery. And people will have noticed, if they've been looking at their value of any investments they've got, or if they've been checking the value of their pension fund on a regular basis, will have noticed that that when the pandemic struck and all of the lockdowns and things took place and furlough was introduced, that at that particular point in time, the FTSE 100 index absolutely sort of went off the edge of a cliff. And there was the financial markets were very jittery, and it took a long time for them to start sort of building the values back up again. And so that was that's the pandemic. What we then had is the war in Ukraine, which has then meant that the quantity of natural gas and oil that's available has been greatly restricted, which has then pushed up the prices of those commodities. From our perspective, the price of petrol went up to more than double what it was previously. It's fallen back a bit now, so it's not at quite such extreme levels. But we had natural gas, which large amounts of it, close on 50% of Europe's natural gas was coming from Russia. And with the sanctions on Russia, it's then meant that that source of cheap natural gas has now been turned off. And that's then pushed the price of gas up. And we've had then the energy companies, and we've had Ofgem, who is the regulator of the energy companies, turning around and saying that the price of energy is going to have to go up, and our energy bills are going to increase extraordinarily over the course of the next sort of 6 months or so, rising from an average household having something like £1,200 a year, £1,500 a year in terms of their overall energy costs, to suddenly a situation where next year we have been warned that we could face energy costs of over £6,000 a year. So like quadrupling the cost of energy. And that not only has created a great shock to people, it's also meant that it's also inflationary, because it's, prices are being pushed up. Now, the government have introduced this energy price guarantee in an effort to stem the problems that have come from the gas prices going up. And so people have now been reassured to some extent that the average annual cost for a household for their energy is going to be fixed at around, well, not fixed, but it should be limited to around about £2,500 a year. So that's not quite so bad, although it is still bad news, which is creating additional financial pressure on people. And of course, we've got rising inflation, where the inflation has been in previous years, up to about March 2021, we'd gone through a period of around about 10 years since the financial crisis that I referred to earlier on, that had taken place in 2007, 2008, that sort of point in time, that we'd had inflation held pretty steady at about 1.5% per annum. And then since March 2021, we've had inflation steadily going up, and the sort of figures that are being talked about now are the government are expecting inflation figures of about 10 or 12% over the course of the year. And of course, when you have inflation at those kind of levels, it's very damaging for people that have got savings. And so this affects elderly people. Lots of elderly people, they don't like taking a risk, so they tend not to want to invest on the stock markets. And so they tend to put their money in banks and building societies, where at the moment they're getting very low rates of interest. Even with interest rates rising, the rate of interest that we're getting, the top savings rates that are being paid, you know, even if you're prepared to leave your money and sort of have your money fixed as a fixed investment over a fixed period of years, the interest rates that are being offered at the moment are still only around about 4%, and yet we're expecting inflation at 10 or 12%. And the point is that if you have inflation at 10%, it only takes 7 years before the value of your savings halves. There's a thing called the rule of 70. If you divide the interest rate into 70, it gives you roughly the number of years that it would take if that was a rate of inflation for the value of your investment to halve. And so, 10 into 70 goes 7. So we're looking at roughly 7 years at 10% inflation for the value of people's investments to halve. And if you're a retired person, you've just retired and you're sort of in your late 60s, you're likely to live into your 80s. All of a sudden, the plans that you had for having a nice, cozy nest egg that was going to see you through your retirement, and see you all the way through to the end of your days, all of a sudden that's halved, you know, over a 10-year period. And in your twilight years, the sort of period between sort of 70 and 80, those people are going to have much less in the way of savings than they thought they were going to have. And in those last few years of their lives, when they should be allowed to have a life free from stress and strife, that they're going to have to penny pinch, and they're going to have to face massive increases in their fuel bills, etc. And so you can imagine how anxious elderly people are feeling as a result of that. What you'll find is that where you have rising inflation, investors initially try to invest in property because they know that if they leave their money in a bank or a building society, it's going to reduce in real terms as the years go by, a half over a 7-year period if inflation's at 10%. So people initially decide to invest in property, which then drives up the prices of houses, which then means that people who are trying to get on the property ladder are finding that the cost of buying a house is constantly accelerating away from them, and it's becoming harder and harder for them to save the money to put down as a deposit on a house. And if interest rates are going up because inflation is there, and when you have inflation, the only way that banks can encourage people to invest in their deposit type of investments is by increasing the interest rates in order to attract those investors. And so with interest rates going up on loans the same way as they would be going up on investments, we find that, you know, young people who are trying to buy their houses are finding that they it's harder and harder for them to afford to buy their house.
But just I mean just to bring it back to with this budget here, so you would think that if people had less tax to pay, they would be pleased because it might be easier for them to afford to buy a house and get on the property ladder because they're paying less tax. I mean, that this is the bit that I don't understand. We can see all the prices are going up, so you would think people would be happy that they're not paying so much tax, wouldn't you? I mean, am I simplifying it too much?
Well, ostensibly you would do, but a lot of the very poorest people in this country don't actually pay tax. And so giving them a reduction in their tax doesn't actually create any benefit to them whatsoever. What you also find is that in the mini budgets, the basic rate of income tax was reduced by 1%, which will affect some people in the middle sort of earnings bracket, but not to a massive degree. But the Kwasi Kwarteng abolished the 45% tax rate, which for people earning over £150,000 a year, which meant that those people would have quite a significant boost to their income, certainly much more than the sort of couple of hundred pounds that would result from a 1% reduction in the in the basic rate of income tax. The mini budget also reduced the levels of corporation tax that are being paid. So large corporations had tax reductions, even though they weren't calling out for them. You know, that they were handed to them on a plate. Here's some massive tax reductions. And so what you had were tax breaks being offered to that disproportionately benefited the wealthy and corporations, and disproportionately less people on normal on average earnings, and hardly at all anybody who doesn't actually pay tax. Somebody who's earning less than £12,570 a year, and so not everybody was happy with the way in which those tax cuts were arranged. And because the tax cuts appeared to be off the wall, so to speak, rather than the sort of things that would have been that people would have discussed and prepared for over a considerable period of time. And again, because the Office of Budgetary Responsibility didn't have foresight of these things, nobody has number crunched to see whether the tax cuts are affordable, and so that's one of the reasons why the mini budget caused concern amongst financial organisations.
Yeah, but then we have the bank having to step in, and you would have thought that the bankers would be pleased because they're not having to pay so much tax on their bonuses. Corporations would be pleased because they're not having to pay so much on of their corporation tax. But then the Bank of England had to step in with extraordinary measures last week. So what was going on there?
Well, what happened there is that when you have very high interest rates go up, it causes the value of investments that are generally regarded as generally referred to as bonds. It causes the value of those bonds to go down, and bonds are effectively investment vehicles that are based around lending the government money. It's very difficult to sort of explain these things just like verbally, but bonds are very often called government stocks. They very often are called gilts because they were supposed to be gold edged so that you couldn't lose if you invested in gilts, because gilts are intended to be very low risk investments. And ordinarily they are at the low risk end of the scale, and what you find is that because they tend to be low risk investments, that pension funds very often will invest in them, because what a pension fund doesn't want to do is to find that because the market's turning in one direction or another direction, that they can't afford to pay the pensions to all the pensioners that they're responsible for maintaining. And so pension funds will tend to invest in government stocks, or otherwise known as gilts or bonds. They'll invest in these because they are low-risk investments, and because the values of bonds tends to move very sort of slowly in kind of shallow sweeping waves. And so the movements in the value of bonds, generally speaking, tends to be fairly predictable. So there's nothing wrong initially in pension companies investing in bonds, but what's happened is that a lot of pension companies, in order to try and boost their yields and in order to improve their investment performance, have invested in recent years in what are called leveraged liability-driven investments. Now, the word liability-driven investment is another word for bond, effectively. So they've been investing in leveraged bonds. Now, what leveraging means is leveraging is where you borrow money in order to magnify the effect of any increase in value in the investments that you buy. So, for example, if you had a house that's worth £100,000. If you're offered a house that's worth £100,000, you may buy that house with £100,000, you may do that on the on the anticipation that house prices are going to go up by, let's say, to keep the figures simple, 50% over the course of the next year. And if you buy that house, and if those prices go up as expected, your house will be worth £150,000 at the end of that period of time, and you will have made a substantial profit of £50,000. And that's absolutely fine. That's what most people, that's what happens when most people buy houses. What they find is that over time they go up in value. And so and that's the way home ownership can actually confer wealth on people. But some people not happy to have just £100,000 house producing for them a £50,000 profit at the end of the year will buy two houses worth £100,000. They'll have the £100,000 of money that they originally had that they'll buy one of the houses with, and they'll borrow another £100,000 to buy the second house. And that's what's called leveraging, because you are creating a situation where you are hoping to get twice the benefit by borrowing by doubling your money available for investment by borrowing that money. And so if you then bought two £100,000 houses, one with the money that you had originally, one with the money that you borrowed, and prices go up by 50%, then those houses in total will be worth £300,000. And if you then deduct the £100,000 that you've borrowed, and you deduct the £100,000 that you originally had, that £300,000 will have produced for you a £100,000 profit, which will be double the profit that you would have had if you'd only had the one £100,000 house. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. So you leverage the first one by getting a loan based on that, in the anticipation that whatever you're buying is going to double in price. So you're making four times what you expected rather than just two times what you expected. So it's taking a risk and betting your whatever you've got as the collateral that the next thing that you're going to buy is going to increase in the price. So that's what these leveraged gilts are then. So that's what the pension funds have done.
That's what these leveraged liability driven investments are. But the problem is, and you hit the nail on the head there when you said about the risk is that if instead of prices going up, prices go down, instead of it doubling the profit that you otherwise would have made by borrowing that extra money to buy that extra house, what happens is that it doubles the loss that you make. So if instead of going up by 50%, house prices went down by 50%, then you would, because you've borrowed £100,000 and you've got to pay that £100,000 back at the end of the day, you will have double the loss. You'll lose £100,000 because you'll have invested £200,000 in two houses, and at the end of that period where you lost 50% of the value of your house, you'd only have £100,000 left, so you'd only have a colossal loss of £100,000 instead of a loss of only £50,000 if you'd stuck to the one house. So the thing to understand basically is that leveraging means that the end result magnifies an upward market movement, but it also magnifies a downward market movement. And the point is that at a time when interest rates are increasing, when the Bank of England's putting interest rates up, when the Bank of England is and where the markets are rattled in the way they are, what's happened for pension funds is that the value of bonds, the value of the leverage driven investments, has dropped. And so instead of benefiting from having leveraged those investments, all these pension funds suddenly found that they'd lost a very substantial amount of money very quickly. And the point is that this, in my view, is a mismanagement of the financial markets, because what's happening is that pension funds are effectively, by using leverage, they are gambling with the money of their pension holders, basically. I don't think that should be should be allowed. When we had the last financial crisis back in 2008, that was as a result of what effectively were junk bonds being sold to banks as if they were low risk investments. And since then, there's been a lot of tightening of regulation, or there should have been a lot of tightening of regulation in the marketplace. The Bank of England have got the Financial Policy Committee, which monitors the markets and is there to sort of guard against systemic risk that might exist on a macro basis under the Bank of England. The Bank of England also has the Prudential Regulatory Authority, which exists to manage those kind of things on a micro basis. And there's also the Treasury, which's got the Financial Conduct Authority, which is there to prevent there being mis-selling and that type of thing. So I don't think the Treasury were particularly to blame here, but I think that the Bank of England and specifically the Financial Policy Committee and the Prudential Regulatory Authority missed an opportunity here to remove a great element of risk from the markets, and so the Bank of England really has got to accept some blame for what's happened, in my view, because they should have realised that these leveraged liability driven investments were a danger and were a more risky investment than the pension funds should have been invested in. The pension funds should have been invested in low risk investments. They should just invest it in gilts and that kind of an investment, plain and simple. But what's happened is that as time goes by, people in the financial world try and invent ever more complex and ingenious ways of investing money to effectively so that they can gamble on the financial markets, but with where the dice are loaded in their favor, and so they can win more often than they lose. But there is always a danger that the markets could move the other way and they could lose. And that's what's happened here with regard to lots of pension funds. And so they've then appealed to the Bank of England, and the Bank of England at the last minute have stepped in and then announced that they're going to be buying up large amounts of gilts over the next sort of 2 weeks or so, which effectively is quantitative easing, which, as we all know, is inflationary. And so here we are at a time when there is inflation that's been caused as a result of furlough being paid to people so that they didn't go to work during the pandemic, which has then been further exacerbated by virtue of the fact that the war in Ukraine has caused energy prices to go through the roof, and the government have now offered this energy price guarantee, which then is going to cost the government money, which means the government have got to borrow more money, which again is going to be inflationary. And because we've had this this range of tax cuts, all of which are going to be inflationary, this is why there's great concern abroad and great concern within financial markets for what's going on at the moment. And it's very often a matter that people are prepared to stick with governments where those governments are able to, firstly, make sure that they've got enough food on the table to feed their family. Secondly, make sure they've got enough money in their bank account so they can heat their house. Make sure they've got the ability to afford a house in the first place. All these things, which are the fundamental things that people need and that people rely on, and without which life becomes intolerable. All these things are the things that governments should ensure are there. And where we've had successive Labour and Conservative governments over sort of past decades, and where those governments have made serious mistakes from time to time, where they've created crises from time to time, as long as they've always been able to provide people with a house over their head, provide them with food on the table, provide them with a job, provide them with the money to be able to afford to heat their home, etc., people have tolerated incompetence by governments. And I think that we're now entering into a phase in our nation's history, which is symptomatic of the decline that's been taking place in Britain over many decades now. We're entering into a phase where governments are becoming so incompetent that they can't guarantee these things any longer. And so, you know, we have these vaunted increases that are going to take place in terms of energy prices. We've had problems with the with petrol becoming very expensive. We've had problems now with interest rates going up at a very sort of marked rate, which is causing the housing market to tank. And it's like all these pigeons or chickens are coming home to roost in one go here with Liz Truss's unfortunate government, and she doesn't really seem to have an answer to all of these problems.
Well, it's like the Conservatives have sabotaged their own success. I mean, they're doing absolutely dreadful in the polls. The Labour Party have gone ahead. I think they've dropped 300 points or something, the Conservatives, the most recent one that I looked at. And Keir Starmer is assuming that he's going to be next in power. But as far as I'm aware, the Labour Party's only solution to this is that they're going to reinstate the top tax rate. And that's about it. They haven't suggested anything else. But just because they're not the Conservatives, I guess, everybody is supporting them. I mean, what do you think of these polls, Max, and the Labour Party? Do you think they could get in again?
Oh, I think that unless the Conservatives manage to do something to save face and get themselves out of this, which in my view is going to involve an almost miraculous outcome, then it's likely that the Conservatives are going to become so unpopular that there will be calls for a general election. There will be very strong calls within the Conservative Party for Liz Truss and Kwasi Kwarteng to change and to retract a lot of what they've done. They don't seem to be prepared to do that, though. And I think if they're not prepared to do it, then that we could have another situation where there are votes of no confidence in the Prime Minister in the House of Commons. And again, we could then have a change of Conservative Conservative leader, or Liz Truss might, in a sort of a moment of despair, might decide to call a general election, because I think this is the sort of thing that you know, a general election perhaps should be called over. The only downside really is that we don't at the moment have a nationalist organisation in Britain that is sufficiently advanced in its development to be able to capitalise on a situation where we have an emergency general election of this sort in the kind of crisis situation that we're in. I've been sort of predicting for many years now that this kind of a crisis will eventually arise as a result of the gradual decline in our sort of economic and prospects and our industrial prospects, in terms of the way in which we're falling behind other countries in terms of industrial development, etc., and where we are too reliant upon international markets, where we are buying our commodities from international markets instead of producing the vital produce that we need to feed ourselves and to provide for ourselves as a nation. Too often we're importing that sort of thing. And you know, when we discussed a couple of weeks or so back the situation with regard to the oil and gas prices, I pointed out then the fact that, you know, we have within our waters around the UK, we've got vast amounts of natural gas, but the governments or successive governments have been closing down the wells and not opening up new wells in order to take advantage of further pockets of gas further afield, and so that's one of the reasons why we're having to import lots of our gas from the continent, and where we do produce our own gas, instead of British gas that's been extracted from British gas wells in the North Sea within British waters, instead of that gas coming to Britain and being given to our people as a priority so that we've got enough gas and at a steady price, what's been happening is that we've made trade agreements whereby the gas that's produced in the North Sea is traded on international markets, which means we then have to compete with other countries to buy our own gas. And And that's why the price of gas has gone up, even though had we continued to bore and extract natural gas in the North Sea, we still would have sufficient gas to provide for our nation, and we wouldn't have suffered the increased costs that have resulted following the war in the Ukraine.
Well, Liz Truss has talked about nationalising the gas or opening up sections of the North Sea so that it can be developed. But it is tragic that we don't have a so-called far-right movement anywhere near government in Britain. I think we're the only country in Europe that doesn't have a credible far-right movement. And, of course, we have Patriotic Alternative, which is community-based, which does a lot of good work, but they don't actually have the size or the clout of being a political party. And obviously the BNP, that fell apart years ago. And we just don't have a political party to take advantage of this, because this could be the time that a nationalist party would actually do well. If you look at the Swedish Democrats, if you look at this new nationalist league coalition in Italy that have just won, if you look at Hungary, you look at Poland, everything is moving towards nationalism, and we don't have a political party here in Britain to take advantage of it, which is a great shame. And hopefully PA will end up getting their whatever it is from the Electoral Commission that they need in order to be registered as a political party, and then something can be done about it. Shall we talk about our greatest Britons, Max? Shall we move on to earlier times in our history?
Yes, let's do that.
Okay, let's talk about our greatest Briton for the week, which is Owain Glyndwr again. We'll start with a recap. Owain was from a noble family with a claim to the Welsh throne. He studied law at the Inns of Court, and he served under the English King Richard II in military service in Scotland. Owain fell out with his neighbour, Baron Grey de Ruthyn, who neglected to tell Owain that his troops were needed for military service, so that he could then denounce him as a traitor to the new king, Henry IV. The deposed King Richard II had support in Wales, and civil disorder broke out in Chester when one of his men was hanged. It was after this that Owain assumed his ancestral title of Prince of Wales and started leading assaults on Grey's lands at first, and later he led his supporters into direct conflict with Henry IV. Much of North and Central Wales flocked to Owain's banner, and Henry IV enacted the Wales penal laws, which were designed to bring the Welsh to heel. But all they did was enrage the Welsh throughout England and Wales, and by 1403, students were leaving Oxford and Cambridge universities to return to Wales to fight for Welsh independence. By this time, many of the castles had been taken by the Welsh insurgents, but they failed to open the ports to French trade, although they did try to gain a treaty with Louis I in Paris. Do you want to make any comments on that, Max? Bring up anything else from last episode?
I'm quite happy with the resume you've given there. I've not got anything that has occurred to me so far.
I do think you made a good point in the last episode about how this wasn't to do with ideology. This was to do with how this was Owain Glyndwr's ancestry. And actually, at this time, there was a lot of different families that sort of had a claim to the throne. We ended up with the Wars of the Roses. We ended up with the Tudors, and we ended up with some of these supporters that supported the English king that were supporting Owain Glyndwr. So it hadn't actually been settled who should actually be the king of England and who should actually be the king of Wales, basically, at the time. So you had all these different families, noble families, that were sort of fighting amongst one another to actually gain that recognition. Although I do think that Owain did have some good ideas about actually governing Wales as well, so that just sort of sets the scene, and we'll continue.
I think you're absolutely right there. The most striking thing about his existence and the life that he led, etc., was the fact that he was one of many men, as you've just described, who were potential monarchs for Britain. And instead of the situation that we have today, where you look around the establishment, you look around Parliament, you look around the country, and there are very few people that in the public eye who have the sort of qualities that one would expect of a monarch. And so we are pretty much, we don't have much of a choice. We're starved of any sort of choice. And the sort of people who are potential monarchs within our country are fairly dismal people in terms of their sort of the vigor that they provide for the nation, and in terms of protecting the people against abuses by government. And yet what we had in the days of Owen Glyndwr, the 15th century, we had a surfeit, really, of men like him who were the representatives of noble families, any one of which could have risen to the fore and been a superb monarch and would have had all of the instincts that one would expect of somebody who is the king of a country. And so there's a marked contrast between the situation that existed then and the situation that exists now.
Yeah, the line of inheritance for the monarchy is all settled now. I guess it wasn't settled back then. I mean, we even had King William of Orange came over and was our king. And the times before that, there was kings from Brittany and Armorica that came over and were kings of Wales. And, of course, William the Norman when he came over. So it was a time when it wasn't settled. And as you say, Max, we had these heroic men of noble stock that were all jostling for recognition. Well, a Senedd, which is the Welsh word for the Parliament, was held in Machynlleth in 1404, where Glyndwr was crowned Prince of Wales in the presence of emissaries from Scotland, France and Spain. Machynlleth may have been chosen due to its central location in Wales and the recently acquired possession of three nearby castles, Castlebere, Aberystwyth Castle and Harlech Castle. And Aberystwyth Castle was originally... I'm thinking of Carnarvon. Carnarvon was the main one that Edward I built, but they're still fairly big castles that have fallen into the Welsh hands here. The Parliament House in Machynlleth is associated with the 1404 Senedd, but the present building is more recent. Local tradition is that the stones used came from the original 1404 building. And I've actually been to this original Parliament House in Machynlleth. It's a great shame that they don't have more to do with Owain Glyndwr there. There's just a small glass box with some paperwork inside it, and that's it. Wales really should have a proper museum that's dedicated to him. Well, in February 1405, Glyndwr negotiated the tripartite indenture with Edmund Mortimer and Henry Percy, the Earl of Northumberland. And the indenture agreed to divide England and Wales among the three of them. Wales would extend as far as the rivers Severn and Mersey, including most of Cheshire, Shropshire and Herefordshire. And the Mortimer Lords of March would take all of the southern and western England, and the Percys would take the north of England. So we can see here that, it was up for grabs, basically. Whoever was entitled or whoever came from a noble family and thought that they could be king, there was a possibility that they could have done. Although negotiations with the Lords of Ireland were unsuccessful, Glyndwr had reason to hope that the French and the Bretons might be more welcoming. He dispatched Gruffydd Yong and his brother-in-law, John Hanmer, to negotiate with the French. And the result was a formal treaty that promised French aid to Glyndwr and the Welsh. The immediate effect seems to have been that joint Welsh and Franco-Breton forces attacked and laid siege to Kidwelly Castle. And they say Breton here, and obviously Brittany was originally a part of the British lands anyway. It was the British monarchy that owned Brittany. That's why it was called Brittany, although it's now a part of France. Scots and French privateers were operating around Wales throughout Owain's War. Scottish ships had raided English settlements on the Llyn Peninsula in 1400 and 1401. And in 1403, a Breton squadron defeated the English in the Channel and devastated Jersey, Guernsey and Plymouth, while the French made a landing on the Isle of Wight. By 1404, they were raiding the coast of England with Welsh troops on board, setting fire to Dartmouth and devastating the coast of Devon. So, I mean, this you had lots of people from the continent that were actually taking part in this. And of course, we talked about the privateers before, these sort of legalised pirates. 1405 was the year of the French in Wales. A formal treaty between Wales and France was negotiated. On the continent, the French pressed the English as the French army invaded English Plantagenet Aquitaine. Simultaneously, the French landed in force at Milford Haven in West Wales and eventually took Pembroke Castle. The combined forces of the French and the Welsh marched through Herefordshire and on into Worcestershire to Woodbury Hill, and there they met the English army just 10 miles from Worcester. The armies took up battle positions daily and viewed each other from a mile without any major action for 8 days. Then, for reasons that have never become clear, the Welsh retreated, and so did the French shortly afterwards. Very strange. Nobody knows why that actually happened. Max, any thoughts on any of that?
It's clear that Owen Glendower had the support of a lot of foreign interests who all had something to gain by the fall of England, really, and the disunity that the alliance that he had made would bring about.
And you also think, I mean, what is this, 1066, sort of going up to 1400? I mean, you've got Norman and you've got Norman descendants that are actually on the throne, and yet you've got Glendower that's making these treaties with the French. So it really shows that France wasn't united at that time, or as united as it is now, or even as united as it was under Charlemagne, I guess, because you would have had certain French that supported the Normans, and then you've got other parts of France which are supporting the Welsh. By 1405, most French forces had withdrawn after politics in Paris shifted towards peace, with the Hundreds' War continuing between England and France. On the 31st of March 1406, Glendower wrote a letter to be sent to Charles VI, the King of France, during a synod at the Welsh Church at Pennell, hence its name. Glendower's letter requested maintained military support from the French to fend off the English in Wales. Glendower suggested that in return he would recognise Benedict XIII of Avignon as the Pope. The letter sets out the ambitions of Glendower of an independent Wales with its own parliament, led by himself as Prince of Wales. These ambitions also included the return of the traditional law of Gwealda rather than the enforced English law, establishment of an independent Welsh church, as well as two universities, one in South Wales and one in North Wales. Following this letter, senior churchmen and important members of society flocked to Glendower's banner, and English resistance was reduced to a few isolated castles, walled towns, and fortified manor houses. So this shows you how important the Pope was to things. And if he would recognise Benedict XIII of Avignon as the Pope, then that would be lending support for this faction within the Roman Catholics as well, that obviously wanted to be in charge of things. And the Pope did have a lot of influence throughout all of these different countries. I mean, that was one of the main reasons why we split from the Roman Catholic Church, was that we thought that the Pope had too much say in the politics within Britain and within other countries as well. Any thoughts on that, Max?
A lot of this is quite new to me, actually, or very new to me, and so I'm just taking in, you know, what I'm learning through listening to you today. So I don't necessarily have any pre-constructed comments to make on some of these points.
It's all fairly new to me as well. Obviously, I live in Wales, and I don't think I've really heard of Owain Glendower until I actually came into Wales. I've been to Machynlleth, which was supposed to be, you know, the central part where they had a museum and all the rest of it, and there really wasn't very much there, which is a great shame. And there's a statue of him that's in North Wales. I mean, he's a great nationalist hero, basically, to the Welsh. This letter is currently held in the Archives Nationale in Paris. Facsimile copies involving specialist aging techniques and moulds of the famous Glendower seal were created by the National Library of Wales, which were presented by the then Heritage Minister Alan Fred Jones to 6 Welsh institutions in 2009. The Royal Great Seal from 1404 was given to Charles IV of France and contains images and Glendower's title in Latin, Owenus de Gratia Princeps Waliae, Owain, by the grace of God, Prince of Wales. So he even had his own seal at the time. During early 1405, the Welsh forces, who had until then won several easy victories, suffered a series of defeats. English forces landed in Anglesey from Ireland and would over time push the Welsh back until the resistance in Anglesey formally ended towards the end of 1406. And Anglesey is in north of Wales. Following the intervention of French forces, battling ensued for years, and in 1406, Prince Henry restored fines and redemption for Welsh soldiers to choose their own fate. Prisoners were taken after battle, and castles were restored to their original owners. This year, a son of Glyndŵr dies in battle. By 1408, Glyndŵr had taken refuge in the north of Wales, having lost his ally from Northumberland. And then on the 21st of December 1411, the King of England issues pardons to all the Welsh, except for their leader and a Thomas of Trumpington, until 9th of April 1413, from which Glyndŵr was no longer accepted. However, this same year, his family were taken hostage by the king, and Glyndŵr died in relative obscurity years later, in maybe 1415 or 1416. So we jumped ahead a little bit there. At the same time, the English changed their strategy. Rather than focusing on punitive expeditions, as favoured by his father, the young Prince Henry adopted a strategy of economic blockades. Using the castles that remained in English control, he gradually began to retake Wales whilst cutting off trade and the supply of weapons. By 1407, this strategy was beginning to bear fruit, even though by this time Owain's rebel soldiers had achieved victories over the king's men as far as Birmingham, where the English were in retreat. In the autumn, Owain's Aberystwyth castle surrendered while he was away fighting, and in 1409 it was the turn of Harlech Castle. Edmund Mortimer died in the final battle, and Owain's wife Margaret, along with two of his daughters and three of Mortimer's granddaughters, were imprisoned in the Tower of London, and they were all to die in the Tower in 1413 and were buried at St. Swithin, London Stone. So the king has issued all these pardons to the Welsh, and yet they still won't turn Glyndŵr in. They remained loyal to him right to the end. Glyndŵr remained free, but he had lost his ancestral home and he was a hunted prince. He continued the rebellion, particularly wanting to avenge his wife. And in 1410, after a suicide raid into rebel-controlled Shropshire, which took many English lives, some of the leading rebels that were supporting him are thought to have been captured. In 1412, Owain led one of the final successful raiding parties with his most faithful soldiers and cut through the king's men. And in an ambush in Brecon, he captured and later ransomed a leading Welsh supporter of King Henry's, Dafydd Gam, English for Crooked David. So there were traitors amongst him, but none of them actually ended up selling him out. But there were traitors that were supporting the English by this time. This was the last time that Owain was seen alive by his enemies, although it was claimed he took refuge with the Scudamore family. As late as 1414, there were rumours that the Herefordshire-based Lollard leader, Sir John Oldcastle, was communicating with Owain, and reinforcements were sent to the major castles in the north and the south. But by then, things were changing. Henry IV died in 1413, and his son, King Henry V, began to adopt a more conciliatory attitude to the Welsh. Royal pardons were offered to the major leaders of the revolt and other opponents of his father's regime. Nothing certain is known of Owain Glyndŵr after 1412. Despite enormous rewards being offered, he was neither captured nor betrayed. He ignored all the royal pardons. Tradition has it that he died and was buried possibly in the church of Saints Mal and Sullian at Corwen, close to his home, or possibly on his estate in Sycharth, or on the estates of his daughter's husband Kentchurch in southern Herefordshire, or Monnington in West Herefordshire. In his book The Mystery of Jack Kent and the Fate of Owain Glyndŵr, Alex Gibbon argues that the folk hero Jack of Kent, also known as Sion Kent, the family chaplain of the Scudamore family, was in fact Owain Glyndŵr himself. Gibbon points out a number of similarities between Sion Kent and Glyndŵr, including physical appearance, age, education and character, and claims that Owain spent his last years living with his daughter Alice, passing himself off as an aged Franciscan friar and family tutor. And there are many folk tales of Glyndŵr donning disguises to gain an advantage over his opponents during the rebellion. Any thoughts on that, Max?
Well, it's just that It was a time of great turmoil, and you know, as we said, because there were so many rival noble families who could have who could have provided a monarch, that in order for somebody to actually become king and to sustain themselves as king, they had to build alliances amongst these families. And although they were able to build these alliances, the alliances weren't necessarily permanent things, and there was a certain amount of shifting sand with people switching sides, and sadly for Owen Glyndwr, he eventually lost everything, really, because you mentioned about losing his castle and his lands, but he also lost his family as well. His wife was held by Henry IV, I think it was, and died, and so it was quite a sad end for him, really.
He should have pressed on when he had the advantage, you know, when the Welsh army were facing off against the English army, and after 8 days, and then the Welsh army backed down. I think they really should have pressed on with their advantage. Adam of Usk, a one-time supporter of Glyndwr, made the following entry in his chronicle under the year 1415. After 4 years in hiding from the king and the realm, Owain Glyndwr died and was buried by his followers in the darkness of night. His grave was discovered by his enemies, however, so he had to be reburied, although it is impossible to discover where he was laid. Thomas Pennant writes that Glyndwr died on the 20th of September, 1415, at the age of 61, which would place his birth at approximately 1354. In 1875, the Reverend Francis Kilvert wrote in his diary that he saw the grave of Owain Glyndwr in the churchyard at Monnington, hard by the church porch and on the western side of it. It is a flat stone of whitish grey, shaped like a rude obelisk figure, sunk deep into the ground in the middle of an oblong patch of earth from which the turf has been pared away and, alas, smashed into several fragments. In 2006, Adrian Jones, the president of the Owain Glyndwr Society, said, 4 years ago, we visited a direct descendant of Glyndwr, a John Skidmore, at Kentchurch Court near Abergavenny. He took us to Mornington Straddle in Herefordshire, where one of Glyndwr's daughters, Alice, lived. Mr. Skidmore told us that he, Glyndwr, spent his last days there and eventually died there. It was a family secret for 600 years, and even Mr. Skidmore's mother, who died shortly before we visited, refused to reveal the secret. There is even a mound where he is believed to be buried at Mornington Straddle. So that would fit in with the other story that said that he went there to live with his daughter. Renowned historian Gruffydd Aled Williams suggests in a 2017 monograph that the burial site is in the Kimbolton Chapel near Leominster, the present parish church of St. James the Great, which used to be the chapelry of Leominster Priory, based upon a number of manuscripts held in the National Archives. Although Kimbolton is an unexceptional and relatively unknown place outside of Herefordshire, it is closely connected to the Scudamore family. Given the existence of other links with Herefordshire, its place within the mystery of Owain Glyndwr's last days cannot be discounted. As of 2015, his final resting place remains uncertain. After his death, Glyndwr acquired mythical status as the hero awaiting a call to return and liberate his people. Thomas Pennant, in his tours in Wales, 1778, 81 and 83, searched out and published many of the legends and places that were associated with the memory of Glyndwr. In the late 19th century, the Cymru Fedd, or the Young Wales Movement, recreated Glyndwr as the father of Welsh nationalism. The creation of the National Assembly for Wales brought him back into the spotlight, and in 2000, celebrations were held all over Wales to commemorate the 600th anniversary of Glyndwr's revolt, including a historic reenactment at the Millennium National Eisteddfod of Wales in Llanelli 2000. Glyndwr is now remembered as a national hero, and numerous small groups have adopted his symbolism to advocate independence or nationalism for Wales. For example, during the 1980s, a group calling themselves Mebion Glyndwr claimed responsibility for the burning of English holiday homes in Wales. Glyndwr came second to Aneurin Bevan in the 100 Welsh Heroes poll of 2003. Stamps were issued with his likeness in 1974 and 2008, and streets, parks and public squares were named after him throughout Wales. There is a campaign to make the 16th of September, the date Glyndwr raised his standard, a public holiday in Wales, including by Dafydd Gwigley in 2021, and many schools and organisations commemorate the day, and street parades, such as the Gwyl y Fflam, the Festival of the Flame, which are held to celebrate it. And interestingly, it was the 16th of September when the new King Charles actually came to the Welsh Senedd, and it was mentioned that this was actually, you know, Owain Glyndwr Day, that the English king came and spoke to the Welsh government there. And Owain Glyndwr as well, he had a reputation for stealing from the rich and handing it out to the poor. So he was a real life Robin Hood, and that was one of the reasons why so many people flocked to his standard and supported him. I mean, there's a lot of background to this. There's a lot of myth around him as well, which likens him to King Arthur, which was another famous Welsh son that is supposed to come back to liberate his people, is supposed to just be sleeping. So you have a lot of folklore that actually surrounds this character as well. And he's a great nationalist hero of the Welsh. He's looked to as the first Welsh nationalist. Max, any thoughts on Owain Glyndwr?
As I said earlier on, I think he can be celebrated as a man of his type, a man who was of noble birth, a man who had aspirations to be king, and who had the courage to act out his desires and to attempt to achieve that greatness. I think, from the point of view of a modern perspective on Owain Glyndwr, it's a shame that so many men of that type had to fight against each other, and the fact that Welsh nationalists who desire the fragmentation of the United Kingdom lionize Owain Glyndwr to the extent that they do, and use his name in order to, as I say, try and fragment the United Kingdom. Because my personal feeling is that the British Isles should be the United Kingdom, and in that I include Southern Ireland as well, because I've visited Southern Ireland on a number of occasions. I don't regard the people there as foreign in any respect. I've visited Northern Ireland on many occasions. I don't regard the people that live there as foreign in any respect. And I think that the United Kingdom would be so much stronger if we were, if the whole of the British Isles were united under one leadership. And as I said earlier on, it's just a shame that men of Owain Glyndwr's calibre and ambition and vision are very few and far between and difficult to find nowadays.
Well, yeah, and like the memory of him was hijacked, really, because as you pointed out, he was supportive of the being part of the United Kingdom. And that was what this tripartite indenture was about. It was about the three of them ruling over Britain, and he'd already served under the English king, and so he'd already showed that he was loyal to him. One of the things that amazes me is, at this time they didn't have newspapers, they didn't have the internet, and yet the word got out and all the students left Oxford and Cambridge to make their way to Wales. So just word of mouth was able to get the news out there that a new hero had arisen and taken on the role of the Prince of Wales and was fighting for his independence. And somehow, all these Welsh supporters were able to make their way back to Wales and hook up with him and find out where the army was to help him. And all of it was just done by word of mouth. I mean, it just seems quite amazing to me in a time when we didn't have televisions, newspapers, the internet, and that's a long way to travel as well. And yet that's what happened.
There would have been hundreds, though, of town criers. It's a job that nobody does nowadays, other than for sort of obscure ceremonial purposes. But I'm pretty sure that each market town would have had a town crier, and the town criers would have had like a circuit, so they would have travelled around perhaps seven towns in 7 days and just continued to go round and round in that same circle of seven towns, picking up the news from the other town criers that they bumped into from time to time and just passing that that information on to within the circle of towns that they served. And so word of mouth in that way can spread pretty quickly.
Yeah, I guess they would have had a postal system as well, or some variation of the postal system. Yeah, it's quite incredible that it managed to hold off the English for all that time as well, and to make all these alliances that he did with the French and the Bretons and the Scottish. And it's just a great shame that he didn't succeed, really. Well, I think we'll have to leave that here for today then, Max. So thank you very much for coming on today.
No, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next week with more Real Britannia for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.